The wedding, the evening with your family, this. But I think we should be discreet.
Are you ashamed of me?
He asked. Oh, God, no, she insisted. We just wouldn't want people making a lot of assumptions about us, wondering if we have future plans, that kind of thing.
God forbid, he said. Don't worry, Sid. I won't embarrass you. You don't have to tell anyone you're knocking boots with a garbage collector.
Oh, Cody, that's not it. I just mean, I don't know what I mean. Let's take it slow, except when we're naked. Then we can do what we want, okay?
He grinned at her and slapped her ass playfully. You're okay, Sid. I'm not going to advertise how I know you're a real blonde. But damn, you're hard to let go of. Maybe we should see if we're still great together in bed. Once more? Just to be sure it's as amazing as I thought. She shook her head.
All right, she said, playfully nipping at his lip. Even though I'm sure, she said.
It's nice to be with you like this, he said.
Until he showed up in Timberlake, she was quite sure she'd never share intimacy like this with anyone again. On the one hand, she was relieved he seemed to know what to do, how to be in a relationship like this. On the other, have there been a lot of women? She asked.
I guess if you started counting with the first one, he said. I guess there were. I wasn't looking for a permanent relationship every time I met a woman I really liked, but I wasn't opposed to the idea.
Have you been in love? She asked.
I have, he said. Have you?
I'm no longer sure, she answered honestly. I thought I loved my husband. I assumed he loved me. When I re-examine that relationship, I'm a little embarrassed that I couldn't see it for what it was. Obviously, I was wrong about many things.
When you re-examined it, did you realize he didn't treat you like he loved you?
Yes, she said.
I'm sorry, but you won't make that mistake again, he said.
And you? Did you learn some painful lessons from being in love? She asked. He was quiet for a moment.
Yeah, he finally said. We'll be okay, Sid. We're going to enjoy life and be a little less alone. When it doesn't work for you, tell me.
And you'll just go away quietly?
How about we don't talk about me going away so soon? But anything you want or need from me.
It's taking a lot of willpower to get out of this bed, she said.
Yeah, me too. But I'll take you home because I don't want you to have regrets, not even about leaving.
I'm really glad I met you, Cody.
Don't call me that in front of people at the bar, okay? I don't want anyone to pick it up. Use it. I love it when you call me Cody. I don't want anyone else to call me that.
Your brother and sisters,
that's them. He said, that's a whole other thing. But when you say it, it feels personal, and I like it.
Then do me one more time, Cody. I love the way you touch me.
Good. Because I can't get enough of you, Sid.
It was 4:09 a.m. when Cal lounged in his favorite chair in the great room, his feet propped up on the ottoman. He'd hoped to be wrong, but he heard a soft sound from upstairs and then the creaking of one stair. He'd intended to do something about that creak. It was kind of loud. But as he heard Sedona sneaking down the stairs, heard her softly curse at the sound, then continue down, he made a decision. He would never fix that stair because he'd have a teenage daughter one day and the alarm could come in handy. Sedona was carrying her shoes in one hand and her suitcase in the other. When she got to the bottom, she put down the suitcase, opened the purse that hung by a strap over her shoulder, and began digging in it. He cleared his throat and she jumped in surprise.
Oh,
she gasped, dropping her shoes. She clutched her blazer over her heart in stunned surprise. After a few breaths, she said,
You scared me. What are you doing up so early?
I've been up, he said.
He dangled her car keys on one finger.
Looking for these?
I didn't want to wake you.
What were you going to do? Leave a note?
I checked with the airline last night, and they had an earlier flight they could put me on. I really need to get home.
Why?
He asked. He sat up, pushed the ottoman out of the way, and put his feet on the floor. I have things to do. The kids need me to be home. Work needs me. You know, just this trip was very short notice.
I called Bob, Cal said. You know, your husband.
Why would you do that? She asked. When did you do that?
Just a little while ago. I didn't wake him. He gets up before 5. He likes to run before 6, before it gets hot. But then you know that, don't you? Sit down, Sedona.
Look, I have a flight, and Denver is a long drive.
Sit down, please, Cal said. He told me.
He doesn't know anything, she said. He has no training whatsoever, and he doesn't know anything. He has opinions, that's all, and it's none of your business.
How long have you been fighting this, concealing this?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Your marriage isn't in trouble because you're a perfectionist. You've been fighting mental illness by trying to maintain control of your surroundings and the people in your life. But it's not working so well. Bob blames himself, you know. He's been so busy and he hasn't taken you to see someone. He trusted you to do it. And you like to excuse what's going on as harmless habits. But he's found you in trouble too often, hasn't he? You don't sleep. You talk to yourself. Or are you talking to someone? Someone the rest of us can't see.
No, she insisted.
He said sometimes you're a little out of reality. You have manic episodes. Man, is your house perfect, right? You're confused sometimes. Forgetful? Or is that compensating? Just agreeing with someone even though you have no memory of what they're telling you? Jesus, Sedona. After what we went through growing up with Jed, why would you accept denial?
Her chin dropped. She slid onto the end of the couch. She spoke as if she'd lost her breath. I can't do this, she said weakly.
Do you know what's wrong, or are you just afraid of what could be wrong?
Cal asked.
Bob said his terms were that you see a doctor, or he's divorcing you and finding a way to get custody. That's what he said. Are you afraid it's schizophrenia? Are you just paralyzed?
I'm functional, she said in a pleading voice. I have it under control. I'm not like Jed at all, and I'm not self-medicating. Everyone gets a little absent-minded sometimes. Lots of women are perfectionists. It's how we manage to be professionals and mothers and wives and—
That's not what it is, Cal said. Bob doesn't enjoy lining up the towels and alphabetizing the canned goods. But if that's the price of peace, he can live with that. It's the insomnia and paranoia. It's the pacing around the basement and talking to yourself for 6 hours through the night that's making him gray. It's finding you curled up in a ball, sweating and crying that he can't take. You need treatment. You need medication. What the fuck is the matter with you? Our lives could have been so different if Jed had been willing to take medication. You have to see a doctor.
I did. I did see a doctor a few years ago. He confirmed what I knew, gave me medication that made me feel dead inside, but not better. And I'm convinced my way of coping is better than the drugs. I'm no threat to anyone, and I manage just fine.
With rituals, walking forward and backward and in circles, cutting vegetables in precise strips, slicing meat in perfect pieces, brushing your hair a certain number of times, doing everything a special way. She swallowed.
Don't you remember how medicine broke him? She cried. How it reduced him to a completely emotionless...
Treatment is better than it was 30 years ago. You don't have to be pumped full of Thorazine and dumped like a blob on someone's couch. You're a psychologist, for God's sake.
The sound of a door opening and feet on the stairs caused them both to turn their heads. Maggie was coming down the stairs.
In 2 more minutes, you'll wake Elizabeth. And if you do, she's all yours.
Sorry, Cal said. It's an emotional issue.
Go put on the coffee, Maggie said. She tightened the belt of her robe and sat on the edge of the ottoman, facing Sedona.
I know you're upset and terrified, but there's no guarantee of his diagnosis. I always encourage my patients to get a second opinion if there's time. You have no idea what's going on, and until you do, enough hysteria.
Bob's absolutely right. Until you see a doctor and get all the facts, you can't call the shots. You could have a brain tumor for all you know.
I don't have a brain tumor, Sedona said. I've run all the tests.
You can't run your own tests, Maggie said. In this family, Cal is in charge of criminal law, you are in charge of personality disorders, and I am in charge of brain tumors.
You're a PhD in clinical psych, and from what I've been told, you specialized in adolescent testing.
A smokescreen, she said. Psychologists and psychiatrists are notorious for studying mental illness because they fear it and want to leg up on their own problems. I did the same thing. I wanted to be sure I wasn't crazy, like our father. I've studied schizophrenia since I was 14.
Well, you can relax now, Sedona, Maggie said. You don't need the pressure of knowing everything. I know some of the best psychiatrists in Denver. I want you to stay with us, or you can use my house in Denver. Probably not for very long, just until I can arrange an evaluation and possible treatment plan for you. I'll walk you through it. I won't let you fall. Working with the brain is a sensitive journey and requires patience. I will be your patience and your crutch. But in case you're confused about what happened here this morning, we just pulled the rug out from under you. Because we all love you, including Bob and your children. It's time for a diagnosis and treatment recommendation. This is what we know as an intervention. I don't think you'll find anyone to help you propagate your denial. And I'm pretty sure it's not schizophrenia, but I'm no expert.
Why do you say that? She asked, sniffing back her tears.
You're functional, socially normal. One of the hallmarks of the disease is thinking you're functional when you're not, thinking your delusions are real and the real world is a delusion.
It's just a mild case.
We're going to let a medical doctor tell you that.
Do Sierra and Dakota have to know about this? She asked, her voice soft.
Well, not today, Maggie said. For today, on a whim, you decided to stay a while. That's good enough for now. Eventually, you people have to talk, for Pete's sake. You're all skipping fearfully around the same gene. At least share your information. Then she looked at Sedona more calmly. How bad are your symptoms?
Sometimes, very frightening, she said. Sometimes I feel pretty normal.
Tell me about very frightening, Maggie urged. Sedona looked down.
When I hear voices, when I can't relax, when I'm paranoid and imagine people know what I'm thinking.
Anything else remarkable?
When the inside of my head is so loud and busy I can't sleep, sometimes for long periods of time. And then, of course, the symptoms get worse and the sleeping aids don't work. Then there are some that work a little too well, and I'm afraid of addiction or of not waking up. I don't think we really know how bad Jed's schizophrenia is with all the potty smokes.
I suggested that at this point it might be counterproductive, Maggie said. Sedona, those symptoms, while suspicious and disconcerting, don't necessarily prove schizophrenia. You might have been describing an overworked, stressed-out, exhausted neurosurgery resident. I'll make some phone calls today. What else can we do to give you some peace of mind? Sedona wore a hopeless expression.
I'm not sure I want any more information about my condition. I'm comfortable thinking it's a light case that flares up sometimes, like when I'm stressed or tired.
But that doesn't really sound like schizophrenia.
Jed had quiet periods, she said.
Cal delivered coffee to Sedona and Maggie.
I shouldn't drink this, Sedona said.
Decaf, Cal replied.
What am I to tell Sierra and Dakota about why I'm still here?
Maggie shrugged. Tell them you and Bob are fighting, talking about separating. You needed some time away and don't care to discuss it. It wouldn't be a lie.
Right, Sedona said.
Maggie smiled. Also not typical of a schizophrenic. They usually say what's on their minds, however bizarre it might be.
Maggie took Sedona's hand. I will find you a good doctor, and I'll take you there myself.
It is not flesh and blood, but the heart, which makes us fathers and sons. Johann Schiller. Chapter 10. Dakota wasn't aware that Sid might say something to her brother about their new relationship. But in thinking about it, of course she would. Sydney and Rob were very close, and Sid spent a great deal of time managing their home and the boys, whenever needed. Fortunately, at 14 and 16, with their father just down the street at the bar and checking in all the time, they didn't need her supervision very often. Sid snuck out to Dakota's cabin Tuesday morning, then excused herself from work a couple of evenings that week. She brought them a hamburger to-go box and said she couldn't stay long, but they made the very most of their time together. Then, a week after Sierra's wedding, when Dakota was having dinner at the bar, Rob brought his food from the kitchen. He placed it in front of Dakota and spoke quietly.
Be very good to her. She's more fragile than she seems.
Startled, Dakota frowned. He thought about answering with some kind of challenge. Then he thought of his own protectiveness of Sierra.
Of course,
he whispered. Rob gave a single nod of his head and turned away. A few minutes later, Sid was standing before him, smiling.
Your brother warned me to be good to you.
I hope you didn't tell him exactly how good you are, she said with a sly smile.
I was a little surprised. Not that he warned me, that you told him.
I had to tell him. If I go mysteriously missing with no explanation, he might call out the search and rescue team. Trust me, it's safer this way. And I told him you were an absolute gentleman. He got a lascivious glint in his eyes.
I'm having very ungentlemanly thoughts of what I'd like to do to you right now. When can I see you?
Dakota whispered. I'm driving the boys to something tomorrow night, batting cage practice. So it would be late any time, he said, grinning.
Do you want to go out?
Maybe on the weekend? Friday night, since I'm committed to marry Jacob on Saturday night.
Perfect. Just decide when and what you'd like to do.
You're very accommodating, Cody, she said so no one could hear.
I'd be pretty stupid not to be,
he said with a grin. I do have to work, she said, just as some uniformed troopers came into the bar for their dinner.
Go,
he said.
I get a big kick out of just watching you.
He enjoyed the sight of her zipping around behind the bar, loved the quick smile on her lips and easy laugh for the customers, even the men he was tempted to be jealous of. The troopers got a fair amount of attention and conversation, and this made Dakota happy because he knew if this was a cop bar, Sid was always in good hands should the need ever arise. But in a sweet little town like Timberlake, the need would seldom arise. It took willpower for him to stay away at all. He knew if he gave in to temptation, he would be here every night from dinner time until she headed home at 9 or 10 or even later. But he didn't want to crowd her, overwhelm her. He had other people to see, even if the urge was not nearly as strong. He usually had dinner with Sully one night a week. Sometimes he'd drop in on Cal, and sometimes Sierra. Sedona had stayed for a few days past the wedding, and even though she could get on his last nerve, he spent one evening at Cal's visiting with his sister. He was more than ready for her to leave. She seemed to be getting a little more nervous and controlling as she got older, and he wasn't too surprised to learn that her husband was threatening divorce if she didn't find a way to curb her perfectionist tendencies. He was watching Sid work when a flash of color distracted him. He turned to see Neely walking into the bar. She looked around briefly, and then, spotting him at the bar, she turned left and went the other way, looking for a table. She looked back at him, and there was no mistaking it. She gave him an angry, nasty look. Neely took a seat on the far side of the room. He couldn't help but notice her attire, and women's clothes were not something he paid a great deal of attention to. But every time he'd seen Neely, she'd been wearing very expensive and what he assumed were incredibly fashionable clothes. Tonight, it was a black leather skirt with a fringe running down one side to the hem, red leather high-heeled boots, and a multicolored leather jacket with a lot of red in it. Her hair was down and full, and even from across the room, he could see her dark eyes and red lips. She didn't look like she was dressed for a casual night in a bar. He was momentarily glad he'd parked his Jeep under a streetlight. She was starting to give him the creeps, coming on to him one minute, glaring at him the next. But then Sid was back, and Neely ceased to exist for him. "I think people are starting to talk," she said. "You're in here too much, and the way you look at me is way too obvious." "Good," he said. "I'd really like to put up a sign. Sid's off the market." "I was already off the market," she corrected. "Then you showed up and I had to slip in judgment."
"Then we both did. I really like it like this."
"I thought we agreed we'd keep it, you know, kind of low-key. Bad divorce and all."
"Listen, I don't know where this is going, Sid," he said in a low voice, barely above a whisper. "But it doesn't matter how we end up. I would never do to you what he did to you. Right now, we're checking it out, and it checks out pretty damn good. How late are you working tonight?"
"Rob went home to have dinner with the boys earlier, so he said I could leave by 9 if I want to. I really need some sleep."
"I'll hang around, get you home."
"But I'm not going out tonight. I'm not going to your place. I really am tired. I must be getting worn out somehow." That made him smile.
"I've never felt so well rested in my life."
"I think there's something seriously wrong with you."
"Not anymore," he said.
On Monday, Dakota's day off, he spent the morning with Sid. After she'd gotten the kids off to school and Rob had gone to work to occupy himself with accounting and ordering supplies, she went to Dakota's cabin. They had a leisurely morning of breakfast, love, quiet talk, and then Sid went home. Dakota was a little afraid of how this morning delight on his day off might change when the boys got out of school. Having seen Neely's reaction to him the previous night, Dakota decided he was going to follow up on his slashed tires with Stan, the police chief. He waited until after the lunch hour was over, then sauntered into the office.
"Hey, Stan," he said. "Got a minute?"
"For you, I got 10,
Stan said cheerfully.
"I'll try to be brief. I wanted to follow up on something. I was wondering if the woman whose tire I was asked to fix came in here to talk to you. Neely? I'm afraid I don't know her last name, but she's unforgettable. Very beautiful, dresses real rich."
Stan frowned.
"Yeah, she was here," he said. "Have a seat, Dakota."
"I don't like that look,"
Dakota said, sitting in front of Stan's desk. They were not alone, which made him even more uncomfortable. There was a civilian woman and another officer, both working in the office. They seemed to be occupied with their own work, but still.
"Did you know she'd be coming in to talk to me?"
Stan asked.
"I asked her to,"
Dakota said.
"I bumped into her and told her how much it pissed me off that my tire was punctured and all the others deflated and that I suspected her, and she told me she had nothing to do with it. She claimed there was some ex-boyfriend who'd been stalking her or something like that. She seemed a little worried that he might have done that, and I asked her to tell you."
"That isn't exactly what she told me," Stan said. "She told me she asked you to help her put on a spare, and after the tire was on, there was a bit of a tussle.
She couldn't call it assault and didn't want to press charges, but she said you crossed the line. You told her you assumed she'd return the favor with affection, and that she shoved you away and slapped your face.
Dakota was speechless. His mouth hung open. He could feel it.
You have got to be kidding,
he said, shock drawing out each word.
Seriously? I'm afraid so,
Stan said.
Jesus! Why didn't you call me? Bring me in for a talking to?
Dakota asked.
Something? You need a talking to, Dakota?
Stan asked sagely.
Aw, hell. It was the other way around. She asked me to fix her tire, but there wasn't anything wrong with the tire, and once we were alone in the alley, she attacked me. Well, she plastered herself against me and kissed me, and I had to peel her off me. You can ask Sid. I left my beer on the bar and was back in less than 10 minutes. Almost all of that time spent walking to the alley and back.
He shook his head.
Holy shit. There is something seriously wrong with that woman. So you didn't come on a little too strong?
Stan asked.
She's been coming on to me, and I guess she's the one who's pissed off. Just so you know, we're trying to play it cool, be discreet. But I'm seeing Sid. I took her to my sister's wedding. We work together at the soup kitchen in Colorado Springs every week. I don't have any interest in this Neely character, and she's real aggressive.
Neely Benedict, Stan supplied.
Then he smiled.
Sid, huh? Don't smile at that, Dakota said.
Why didn't you tell me I was accused of assault?
Well, it's not exactly assault as it was described, and there doesn't seem to be a victim, since she said she wasn't pressing charges. She just wanted me to be aware on the chance you're a little off and we have trouble with you.
On the chance I'm a little off? He asked incredulously.
And then there's the fact that I wasn't inclined to believe her,
Stan said. Dakota sat back in his chair and let all the breath he didn't realize he was holding escape. He ran a hand through his hair.
Well, thanks for saving that for last.
You might have told me up front about the disagreement, about being set up for some romantic purpose,
Stan said.
Yeah, Cal suggested that.
But I watched her get in her car, and I had no desire to make trouble for her. I was very stern, told her never to do that again, and thought the matter was taken care of. I suspected her of the damage, but I didn't have proof.
I know you didn't do what she said,
Stan said.
I have something to show you. Give me a second.
Stan clicked the keyboard on his computer, then turned the screen toward Dakota. It was a dark image. Dakota squinted to make it out. Neely's red wrap made it easier. And that was him, bending to look at the tire, then standing only to have her lunge at him, and he grappled to push her off.
Jesus,
he said.
There it is. Oh, there's more.
Indeed. It took Neely quite a while to get out of her car after he'd left the alley. And then, looking around cautiously, she bent to the task of letting the air out of his tires.
What's that in her hand? He asked.
A tire deflator, Stan said. With a light.
When there was only one tire left, she went back to her car, dug around inside, then went after the final tire with a knife. Dakota winced when he saw that. Stan turned the screen back.
Obviously, I'd like you to say nothing about this.
Where'd you get it?
Security camera on the back of the bank. It's not very obvious. Apparently, she wasn't aware of it. A lot of people think a little hick town like Timberlake wouldn't have any use for such a thing.
Are you going to arrest her?
Stan shook his head.
The image isn't quite clear enough. Besides, it would only be a misdemeanor. She might not even get a fine. I'm going to hold on to this while I look a little deeper. This is going to stay between you and me. That's all I'm prepared to say. Except I don't know that you should turn your back when this woman is around.
Don't worry.
I hadn't even looked at this tape yet when she paid me a visit. Not that I don't take you seriously, but it was air let out of three tires. Not exactly high crime.
but I found her whole presentation a little odd. She is real pretty, though. Oh, and about Sid, you don't have to be so secretive. Everyone knows you like her. No one would be surprised your steadies.
Great, he said.
She wanted us to go slow, not start up the gossip. Then you ought not to be on the same bar stool 3 nights a week unless you can manage to drink a little heavier.
Then he laughed, but it was more of a giggle. Dakota made a face.
Small town, Stan said. Just when you think you've got a secret.
So, where do we go from here?
Stan folded his hands on top of his desk.
I'll be collecting information. I don't have much use for people who do things like that. I try to think of ways to request their departure from my beat. As for you, go about your business and see what you can do to be less irresistible to the ladies.
Hmm?
It's not funny, Dakota said. I'm not exactly laughing, Stan said.
Dakota could admit to himself that he'd been lucky with the ladies over the years, but he'd never been in a situation like Neely in the alley.
Will you give me a call if you find out something more?
I can do that, Stan said.
Listen, I don't consider myself a wise man. I have a little experience, that's all. But I'm going to tell you something. Don't think I'm talking down to you or anything, but just in general, I've discovered men are stupid. In a situation like this, for example, you're probably thinking you don't have much to worry about up against a girl. And maybe you don't. You're definitely stronger. Probably smarter, too. But if you smell an ill wind, you'd be smart to pay attention. Men tend to think just because it's a girl.
She creeped you out, too, Dakota said.
I'm just saying. I don't take too much for granted. I know it don't seem like it, Timberlake being a small and uncomplicated town, but we've had us a situation or two I could probably sell to a movie channel.
Dakota smiled.
How long you been doing this, Stan? He asked. Too damn long. 25 years now, and retirement is not in sight. Got 4 kids and 3 dogs and a happy wife. At least she was happy last time I checked. If it ain't broke... I'd like to buy you a beer sometime. Here's some tales. I'd like to hear that one about Maggie shooting some guys who kidnapped a girl. Cal can't seem to even talk about it.
Again, Stan's laugh was almost a giggle.
That sure riled him up, didn't it? I'll be the first to admit, took about 10 years off my life. That woman's so frickin' headstrong. If I ever get a blood clot in my brain, I want her in the operating room with me. But the rest of the time,
he shook his head.
It takes a big man. That's all I'm saying.
Starting right after their wedding, Sierra and Connie endured several long interviews. Some of the people listed as their references had been contacted. Their home had been inspected, and their dog had even been evaluated. And the process wasn't nearly complete. But it wasn't for their certification to be foster parents. No, it was more intense and permanent than that. The baby Connie had rescued from the car accident was named Samuel Ryan Juergens, and his mother had called him Sammy. His maternal grandmother was his legal guardian, but she wasn't up to the job given her chronic illness. She suffered from rheumatoid arthritis and a spinal injury that left her weak and in pain. She had more difficult days than easy ones, not to mention the fact that she was 60 and widowed. Sammy's mother had not married, and on his birth certificate, the father was listed as unknown. Mrs. Juergens had no idea who Sammy's father was, and according to her, there hadn't been a man in her daughter's and grandson's life. Rachel Juergens had planned to give up the baby, but instead had moved home to her mother's house in order to take care of them both. Rachel had been only 20. There were other family members, cousins, though they hadn't seen each other in years. Rachel had no siblings. While Sam was in foster care with Rafe and Lisa, Mrs. Juergens had sought the counseling help from social services, and they had come up with a solution. An open adoption. That way Sam might know his biological grandmother through visitation, and some of the information about his family history would be passed on. After a great deal of talking and soul-searching, Sierra and Connie decided this was the answer for them. They wanted to make that sweet little baby their son. It was arranged privately through an attorney. The second Lisa Vadas heard of the plan, she told Sierra and Connie, there would be no shortage of couples waiting to adopt who would step up, but there was only one man who had actually pulled the little baby from a decimated car. Connie and Sierra would be allowed to foster Sammy until the adoption could be finalized. It would take 6 months to become his legal parents. It was June. School was out for summer vacation, and for weeks, Sierra had paid almost daily visits to the Vadas household to be with little Sam. While Sierra and Connie were screened, the new family was bonding. Finally, they were approved for foster care pending adoption, and today was the day they could finally pick Sam up and take him home. They had asked Connie's mom and brother to come to Timberlake for dinner and a surprise. They issued the same invitation to Sully, Cal, Maggie, Elizabeth, and Dakota. They encouraged Dakota to bring Sid if he wished.
I'm gonna ask you one more time, Connie said to Sierra. Any answer is all right as long as it's honest. The only thing is, we can't change our minds. No matter what bucket of trouble or difficulty we might face, we're in this forever. There are lots of young couples waiting to be parents if you're not ready, so be sure. Can we do this?
Sierra smiled sweetly and touched her husband's handsome face. I'm absolutely sure, she said. I'm so in love with him.
Have we covered everything?
Connie asked. I think so, she said. If a father turns up, we can manage some visitation, provided he's of good character. We'll be honest with Sam about his roots. If he has medical issues, we're in for the long haul. Same with any behavioral issues. And if he grows taller and stronger than you, you promise not to be jealous.
You were afraid to have your own child because of possible genetic schizophrenia. We have only his grandmother's word on the family medical history, and I think she's a little wacko if you want the truth. What if Sam has mental illness in his family history?
I thought we covered that under medical issues, she said. We will be his champions. We will get him the best medical help if we need to. Remember, we have Maggie in our corner. Connie, please don't make me beg. Sam should live with us. We love him. We have a bond with him.
Wanna make another run through the inventory?
He asked. We're ready, Sierra said. It had been some very busy weeks since their wedding. First, meetings with Mrs. Jurgens and the attorney and the social worker. Then to Denver to trade in Sierra's little orange VW, affectionately known as the Pumpkin. She was now the proud owner of a medium-sized Honda SUV. It was not orange, but silver. And then there was furniture for the baby, though the crib was in their bedroom for now. Supplies from diapers and wipes to towels, blankets and bottles were neatly stored. The room that would be Sam's was painted powder blue and yellow, but he would be with Sierra and Connie for a while until everyone was comfortable and sleeping through the night. Sam had some clothes, but Sierra still purchased more. She'd had a field day at Target.
Okay, the lasagna is in the slow cooker, salad in the fridge, bread hidden from Molly in the cupboard, chocolate cake under the glass dome, also safe from Molly, plates and utensils ready for company.
Connie ticked off the items, making Sierra laugh.
Please, can we go get him now?
They had a brand new approved car seat. There were some things that a firefighter was very handy with. Anything to do with safety for children was a particular specialty. They had a baby swing, a high chair, a changing table. There were new toys, a lullaby music box, a play box for the crib, and a playpen. Lisa had been packing up Sam's things all morning. There was little enough to get ready. There were still some things at Mrs. Jurgens's house, but much of it was secondhand, from thrift shops or hand-me-downs, and Rachel hadn't been well-stocked.
the baby being so young. One thing for which everyone gave grateful thanks, she hadn't scrimped on the car seat. It had been high quality and saved his life. When they walked into the Vadas home, the whole family was there. Sam was in the high chair being fed lunch, cereal, vegetables, and strained fruit. It wasn't only all over his face, but when he saw the spoon coming, his mouth opened wide and he lunged toward it. When he saw Sierra and Connie, he grinned his most handsome toothless grin. "Oh, my heart," Sierra said in a breath. "We're all so relieved Sam isn't going far," Lisa said. "This time, we won't have a hard time letting him go." Sierra pulled a chair out from the table and sat beside Lisa. "We're a little bit scared. What if something goes wrong and we can't adopt him?"
"I understand completely," Lisa said, "but there's nothing to suggest that will happen. After just a few days, you'll relax and enjoy him."
"You'll be exhausted and forget to worry,"
Rafe yelled from the living room. "As soon as he's had his lunch, why don't you give him his bottle? He'll probably nap for a while and be fresh and happy for his party. Is there anything I can do to help?"
"We're ready. Molly is home guarding the slow cooker."
"Do you think your family will be at all surprised?"
"Well, they don't know we've been stocking up on baby things," Sierra said. "But they do know we've been visiting Sam every day. I tried to be secretive, but it just wasn't in me. I talk about him all the time."
"How have you kept them away from your house and the blossoming nursery?"
"That was easy. We checked in at the crossing often, dropped in on Maggie and Cal regularly. Dakota has a girlfriend, and Sedona has gone home. No one bothers us."
"Oh, they're going to be so surprised," Lisa said. "And the diner?"
"We had long talks about it, and I'm going to continue to work 2 days a week. I'll work on Connie's days off. It was his suggestion. He thinks if I give up the diner and all the people I'm used to seeing in town, I might get lonely and bored. I'm going along with this for now, and we'll see what happens. I think I'm a little too busy with Sully and the rest of the family to get lonely, but..."
She shrugged.
"He has a point," Lisa said.
"Anything that gets you out of mommy mode on a regular basis helps keep you in balance, especially if you feel like you're contributing. Everyone should feel they're contributing. The guys, the kids, the moms. That's my philosophy."
"That's her philosophy,"
her oldest child said.
2 days at the diner isn't going to contribute much," Sierra said with a laugh.
"Just be careful that you don't find yourself feeling lonely and unappreciated because you're trapped at home with the kids and the only thing you do is take care of other people and collect complaints from them."
"Gotcha," she said.
"It's easy to ignore your own confidence and self-esteem when everyone seems to need something all the time."
"We should probably have this conversation in a few months," Sierra said. "Right now, I just want to hold Sam and love him."
Lisa wiped off his face and dropped a kiss onto his head. "He is the sweetest baby we've ever had."
"I don't have any trouble believing that. Would you like to join us for dinner?" Sierra asked.
"We're going to have lots of dinners together," Lisa said.
"Today is for you and your family. A little time to get to know Sam. They're going to be so happy."
"Lucky Elizabeth, a cousin." A few hours later, amid tears and laughter, little Sam was passed from person to person, cuddled and petted, tossed up in the air, bounced on knees, and he treated them all to the most handsome toothless grins. Sully had more turns with the baby than Sierra expected. As he held him and jiggled him, he said,
"Yeah, I guess you're a keeper. Best looking guy at the party."
That best portion of a good man's life? His little, nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and of love. William Wordsworth. Chapter 11. Sedona hadn't gone home at all, as she requested Dakota and Sierra be told. Instead, she'd agreed to an inpatient mental health facility.
That took some doing. At first, she'd resisted the very idea. Checking into a hospital, even if it was as plush as any resort, hadn't been part of her plan. Her plan had been to continue to cope by controlling her environment and keeping secret her greatest fear, that she would soon be as out of reality as her father had been since before she was born. She had gone with Maggie to Denver, stayed with Maggie in her house, and kept a few appointments with a psychiatrist by the name of Nan Tayama, a gentlewoman of Burmese descent. "I've known Nan for years," Maggie said. "She is the smartest woman in the world, I think, and probably the kindest. But if you don't connect with her, I know others we can try."
"How is it you know so many psychiatrists?" Sedona asked.
"We like the same part of the body, the brain. I like the physiology, they like the chemistry."
"It's going to take a lot more than chemistry," Sedona said.
"You don't know anything yet," Maggie said. "First, you have to be honest about what's happening with you." Sedona tried her hardest. She gave Nan the benefit of the doubt. Nan was a tiny woman dressed in a suit that made Sedona wonder where she found professional-looking clothes made in such a small size. She assumed Nan was as smart and intuitive as Maggie said, and tried to open up. She explained that she'd started having manic episodes. Her heart would pound violently, and she suffered from insomnia. Then the voices began. Usually it was her mother's voice, telling her what to do. She'd already had 2 children and believed she was out of the woods for schizophrenia since she was in her late 20s. She used the excuse of needing to be available for her kids and asked about working from home. Her employers accommodated her. Now, looking back, she wondered if they knew something was wrong with her and preferred to keep her out of the office. She was running analyses of psychological testing. It really wasn't necessary that she be available for meetings or presentations as long as she supplied regular reports. And she did. Long, meticulous reports. Being alone was better for her. She muttered to herself constantly. Unless Bob or the kids were around, then, by sheer dint of will, she shut her mouth. She went to see a psychiatrist with a good reputation, and he immediately prescribed therapy and medication. But when she couldn't wake up for the children, she stopped taking it and never went back. She was smart enough to know that meds without therapy or therapy without meds just wouldn't do it. So to cover what she knew was wrong, she made herself a rigid schedule that would disguise the fact that she didn't want to leave the house, didn't want to be with people. She went to the grocery store on Mondays, ran other errands on Thursdays, saw her parents 2x a year. If her schedule went awry for any reason, it was torture. But no one knew, because it was apparent she used her time very well. Her house was perfect, her cooking delicious, her children excelled in school. Of course, Bob wanted a social life, but she declined so often he all but gave up. She'd toss in a labored acceptance sometimes, just to keep the peace. He might be having an affair. She didn't know. Didn't really care. Not as long as her life was routine and no one knew her secret. But it got worse, which of course was her worst fear. She experienced memory loss and confusion. She began to see things. Animals in the refrigerator. The walls were crying. There was someone hiding in the closet in her bedroom, and she was terrified to look. She couldn't lie still in the dark. It made her bones itch. So she went to the basement. To read, she told Bob. But really, she paced and muttered and tried to will it away. She admitted to Dr. Tayama that she'd thought about suicide. After her assessment, Sedona spent 10 days in the inpatient facility, talking to the psychiatrist every day, taking medicine, enduring group sessions that for her were impossibly terrible. One thing she did grudgingly admit— the drugs weren't as bad as the ones she'd been prescribed several years ago, and probably 1,000 times better than the ones her father had tried. She was resting better, though she'd wake up confused about where she was until she got her bearings. She walked into Dr. Tayama's office for her regular appointment.
"I'm so happy to see you, Sedona. You look well. A
Are you having a good day?
I think I would like it better if I could have a normal day, she said.
Then I have good news, Dr. Tayama said. You are normal. Not average, perhaps, but normal. Your version of normal.
It would feel good to be everyone else's version, Sedona said.
Ah, that would be a problem. It doesn't exist. I know it's hard to be objective when you're so far out of your comfort zone, but do you think the meds you've been taking are helping? Are you getting some sleep? Are the voices and images relaxing?
I suppose, she said.
Whatever you're giving me is an improvement over what Dr. Shizak gave me. That was a combination of Meloril and Haldol. I don't know how you even got out of bed. I prescribe something that has less tranquilizing effect and isn't an antipsychotic. I thought there was a fair chance your confusion, memory lapses, and voices were induced by anxiety-provoked insomnia. Go long enough without sufficient sleep, and your brain will conjure anything.
Anxiety? Sedona said.
Dr. Tayama nodded. It's a smorgasbord of issues. Anxiety that produces isolation and sometimes antisocial behavior, insomnia, depression. Add to that some OCD. I'm still not sure if it's the chicken or the egg. Was your OCD severe enough to cause anxiety, or did your anxiety lead you to attempt to control your environment as though you had OCD? In any case, to be conservative, I wanted to try a drug for anxiety and one for OCD. They behave as well as an antidepressant with some sedative side effects, just not as severe. It seems to be working. You seem alert and rested.
But Dr. Shizak said I was schizophrenic.
Dr. Tayama shook her head. I don't think so. I think you told Dr. Shizak you were schizophrenic, like your father, when in fact you had a few symptoms that masqueraded as that disorder. Sedona pushed back into her chair.
Anxiety, she said.
She laughed as if in relief.
Of all the...
It can be very serious, as you can attest. You're not out of the woods, Sedona. Anxiety and OCD have complicated your life, your relationships, your peace of mind, even some cognition. You have work to do. Drug therapy and counseling.
But it's just anxiety,
she said emphatically. You thought about suicide, Dr. Tayama reminded her. The anxiety was so alienating and frustrating it caused depression. Not following a treatment plan.
I think I'll go home now,
Sedona said abruptly as she stood to leave. Please take a seat and hear me out, the doctor said. If you leave now, it will be exiting a mental health hospital against medical advice. You don't have the best pharmaceutical protocol in place. I can't just write you a prescription or give you a handful of pills. You need treatment, Sedona. Anxiety isn't a state of mind. It's a brain chemistry issue, just like depression or schizophrenia. You are not in control. Not yet. But your prognosis is good.
I'll be fine now. Now that I know it's not my father's disease, the anxiety will go away.
Not likely, the doctor said. You're a psychologist, Sedona. You know severe anxiety isn't nervousness or phobia.
I spent years recommending behavior modification for students with test anxiety, and it's been very successful. Thank you, doctor. You've been a lifesaver.
I realize you're feeling much better, but leaving treatment now is a very big risk. I think we should talk with your husband or siblings, arrange your aftercare, get you set up with psychiatric coverage for medication and a good counselor.
I can handle it, she said. I know exactly what to do.
The doctor stood, but she had to look up to meet Sedona's eyes. This has happened before, Sedona, often with disastrous results. I wish you would stay for a while. Let us complete an evaluation, so when you do go home, you have the best possible opportunity for a better quality of life.
I appreciate your effort, Sedona said. But I hate it here. Hate it. I want my home, my family, my bed.
So would I, Dr. Tayama confessed.
It won't be too much longer. Please, you're not entirely well.
I know. My version of normal, you said.
It's manageable, but we need time. You need time. Patience.
Thank you. Goodbye, then.
Sedona, take my card, she said. She scribbled on the back. My cell number in case of an emergency. Call me if you need me. Sedona, feeling brand new, took the card.